This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran does not intend to leave talks on the revival of JCPOA, but it won't back down from its stance in the negotiations. Dozens of flights are canceled across Europe as a staff from budget Irish airline Ryanair go on a strike to protest their working conditions. Also coming up, heads of the Group of Seven leading economies are getting together in Germany for a summit amid protests against the gathering. Live from our Tehran studios, this is World News with me, your host, Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Top story, Iran's president has slammed the recent anti-Tehran resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors, saying that the measure won't force the Islamic Republic to back down from its stance in the Vienna talks.
Negotiations will continue. We don't want to stop the talks, but we have said many times that this resolution cannot force us to back down from a stance. Our negotiators will engage in dignified negotiations to restore the rights of the Iranian people. This has been stressed in meetings with European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell.
In a televised interview, Raisi said that the improper resolution was put forward while Iran was in the middle of the JCPOA revival talks and cooperating fully with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The comments were made shortly after Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahi and EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell met in Tehran and announced talks on reviving the 2015 deal will resume soon. Borrell also met with the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani told him Iran's remedial measures in the nuclear sector are a legal and rational response to U.S. unilateralism and Europe's inaction. He added that Tehran will continue the measures as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agree today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A senior Palestinian resistance official is warning that an upcoming visit by U.S. president to the region is aimed at undermining the Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation. The head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, says that the visit is also part of efforts to increase Israel's clout. Biden will travel to Israel in mid-July, and from there, he'll directly fly to Saudi Arabia. Haniyeh called for unity and integration of all resistance friends in the region to counter Israeli infiltration. He warned of U.S.-Israeli plots for regional realignments that go beyond normalization deals with some Arab states. And he said that involves the inclusion of Israel in regional military and security coalitions to counter the resistance front in Palestine and across the region. Israeli firefighting teams are trying to contain a massive fire that has ripped through a number of industrial structures in the city of Haifa. According to Palestinian sources, a huge blaze broke out at industrial facilities containing hazardous materials. They also say that several explosions were heard in the area. Firefighting crew are on the ground trying to keep the fire from spreading to surrounding areas. Many of the homes in the immediate vicinity have been evacuated as a precautionary measure. Three people have been reportedly rescued. A huge plume of smoke has blanketed the region. Haifa has seen similar incidents recently. A wave of airline strikes hitting Europe amid a widespread labor unrest across the continent. Airline staff in Britain, Italy, France, and Spain are staging walkouts, demanding better pay and working conditions. Hundreds of flights have been canceled due to staff shortages. In Spain, the transport union says the strike and staff are being replaced by temporary workers brought in from other countries. But the act is criticized for violating the right to strike. Earlier this week, some 40,000 railway workers in Britain staged a three-day strike over pay disputes, affecting thousands of commuters. Concerns are growing about a summer of strikes across Europe. The continent is currently suffering from skyrocketing inflation and stagnant economic growth. The aviation industry is already under pressure due to staff shortages caused by mass layoffs during the pandemic. Meantime, protests and strikes continue in Italy as the country is suffering from sharply rising energy costs and growing inflation. Movements and associations representing different layers of society have been staging protests for months, demanding support for the government. Max Civoli reports from Rome.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector.
The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month.
Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Now, staying with Europe, leaders of a group of seven leading economic powers are gathering in the Bavarian Alps in Germany for a three-day summit. The talks will focus on the current global energy shortages and soaring prices worsened by the Russia-Ukraine war. G7 leaders are expected to show a united front and back in Ukraine and ramping up pressure on the Kremlin. The global food crisis and climate change will also be at the heart of conversation. Thousands of police officers are tasked with ensuring security for the visiting leaders. Just a day ahead of the summit, around 4,000 people turned out in the streets of Munich for a largely peaceful protest. There were minor reports of the scuffles with police. Protesters are critical of globalization. Their other demands include a phasing out of fossil fuels, social justice, and greater efforts to combat hunger. The people taking to the streets in different cities across the U.S. for a second day to protest the Supreme Court's decision to end abortion rights. Thousands gathered outside a top court in Washington, carrying signs that called the decision a war on women. Similar events were held in Los Angeles a day after city witnessed violent clashes between police and women's rights activists. Abortion rights were introduced as a constitutional protection for women 50 years ago, but at least eight conservative-led states have now imposed bans on the procedure, and several others are planning to do the same in the coming weeks. The Supreme Court's ruling has also drawn criticism from Democratic President Joe Biden, who has called the move shocking. And over to Ecuador, President Guillermo Lasso will know in the coming days whether or not he can continue to serve in his post. The National Assembly is holding a no-confidence hearing for the president. Parliament will have 72 hours to decide whether or not to oust the president once the debate is over. For nearly 2 weeks now, the country has been the scene of indigenous protests against the rising fuel and food prices. The number of protesters is estimated to be around 14,000, most of them in capital Quito. Lasso accuses them of planning to stage a coup. So far, six people have been killed and dozens injured in the violence. Opposition lawmakers are blaming Lasso for the current political and social upheaval. Meantime, protesters say they won't stop until they get what they're asking for. As relief efforts continue in Kuwait, Afghanistan, calls are growing on the United States to release the Afghan frozen funds. Hashtag Trending is next with a review of social media comments on that story.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. On Wednesday, Afghanistan was struck with a strong earthquake that caused massive destructions and killed hundreds and hundreds of people. Stay tuned to see the reaction of social media to the story. The magnitude of the devastation was so high that the Taliban government appealed to the international community and global charities for help, saying that the crisis-stricken Afghanistan lacks sufficient medicine and equipment to heal the wounded. Living through hell on earth, that's the situation in Afghanistan for the civilians who survived the country's deadliest earthquake in two decades. Thousands of people are left without food, water, or shelter as they wait in remote villages for aid. Our first comment comes from correspondent UK. Aid trickled to devastated villages in remote parts of Afghanistan on Friday, but thousands of people remain without food, shelter, and water 3 days after the country's deadliest earthquake in decades. Melody Lee G said the citizens of Afghanistan are yet again living through hell on earth due to the hashtag earthquake Afghanistan. Please donate if you can through legitimate aid agencies. Zakirullah Omar had our next tweet. The international aid community is not leaving Afghanistan alone in this dire situation. Afghans need your help more than any other brother in this situation. We have been severely affected by the earthquake in Paktika. Meanwhile, calls are growing on the United States to act responsibly and release the $7 billion of Afghan funds frozen by Washington, despite the country being cut off from much foreign assistance because of sanctions. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by No War But Class War. In the wake of the earthquake that has taken the lives of over 1,000 Afghans, now is the time to act decisively to aid the Afghan people. At President of the United States, we urge you to end the economic strangulation of Afghanistan and ensure Afghans get the relief they need now. Space said, that's the point of all U.S. sanctions, to be honest. Make the conditions in a nation so unbearable in order to force regime change. I believe they said the same regarding the Afghanistan humanitarian aid being frozen. The next tweet comes from Ayu Adialu. They said, can you believe the so-called pro-human rights West cited women's rights as a reason not to provide humanitarian aid to Afghanistan in light of a devastating earthquake and instead sanctioned the country from receiving materials or aid of any kind? Max tweeted that the White House left the country in ruins and facing an enormous humanitarian catastrophe. Throughout the 20 years of occupation, the U.S. and its allies did nothing to develop Afghanistan. Instead, its economy was shattered, its agriculture undermined by so-called aid. As some international organizations and Afghanistan's neighbors dispatch aid packages to the crisis-hit country, many social media users are blaming the United States and other rich Western countries for standing idly by and refusing to help the desperate Afghans. Let's take a look at our final batch of comments. Ujjal Hussein said, NATO regimes sanction Afghanistan and steal $7 billion. Heavily sanctioned Iran sends aid to Afghanistan earthquake survivors. Our next comment comes from Zaid Lohia. In the Afghanistan earthquake, 1,000 are already killed, 1,500 are injured, and many are buried under ruined homes. Rich countries are silently watching, and the UN is struggling to find resources to help. Already, two-thirds of Afghans are dependent on UN food aid. And our final comments come from Momo. Sanctions imposed on the Taliban and Afghanistan's economic collapse have made it extremely difficult to respond with medical aid and food for the country. The situation in the devastated nation is made significantly worse by the West freezing billions of dollars of Afghan reserves. Well, that's a wrap for another hashtag trending. Take care and bye-bye.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight. The New York laws struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. We now present you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, U.S. Supreme Court Overturns New York Handgun Law in Bitter Blow to Gun Control Push. The U.S. Supreme Court has opened the door for almost all law-abiding Americans to carry concealed and loaded handguns in public, after a conservative majority struck down a New York law that placed strict restrictions on firearms outside of the home. The governor of New York, a Democrat, said the ruling was not just reckless, it's reprehensible. Pointing to recent mass shooting incidents in New York and Texas, a leading progressive group called the ruling shameful and outrageous. President Joe Biden said this ruling contradicts both common sense and the Constitution and should deeply trouble us all. On the left, outrage is growing over the court's rightward march. Recently, the court handed down a ruling which attacked the separation of church and state. As soon as Friday, 24th of June, it is expected to undermine or remove the right to abortion, guaranteed since 1973, and to reduce the federal government's ability to cut emissions, contributing to the climate crisis. The New York law struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. In his ruling, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "Apart from a few late 19th century outlier jurisdictions, American governments simply have not broadly prohibited the public carry of commonly used firearms for personal defense. Nor have they generally required law-abiding, responsible citizens to demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community to carry arms in public." Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "The New York law also violated the 14th Amendment, which made Second Amendment rights applicable to the states." President Biden pointed to the longevity of the New York gun laws and to past Supreme Court acceptance of the need to regulate gun ownership. President Biden said since 1911, the state of New York has required individuals who would like to carry a concealed weapon in public to show a need to do so for the purpose of self-defense and to require a license. More than a century later, the United States Supreme Court has chosen to strike down New York's long-established authority to protect its citizens. President Biden added, "As the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia recognized, the Second Amendment is not absolute. For centuries, states have regulated who may purchase or possess weapons, the types of weapons they may use, and the places they may carry those weapons. The courts have upheld these regulations." President Biden noted, "I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Lives are on the line. The ruling has profound implications for the safety and conduct of up to 83 million people in New York and seven other states plus Washington, D.C., with similar proper cause laws. They include heavily populated states such as California and New Jersey, which account for roughly 3 out of every 4 Americans. Just weeks ago, an 18-year-old carrying a legally bought assault rifle shot and killed 10 people in a racist attack on a supermarket in a majority black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York. Just 10 days later, another 18-year-old teenager broke into an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and killed 19 children and 2 adults before being shot dead by law enforcement. Democratic and Republican senators have since agreed a framework for gun reform. On Thursday, 23rd of June, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said the proposals did not lay one finger on the Second Amendment and would make the country safer. But any gun legislation inevitably faces strong headwinds, with the potential to blow all the way to the court. McConnell helped pack with conservatives. In his dissent to the New York ruling, Chief Justice Stephen Breyer, a liberal justice soon to retire, wrote, "In 2020, 45,222 Americans were killed by firearms. Since the start of this year, there have been 277 reported mass shooting incidents, an average of more than one per day." Justice Stephen Breyer said, "Gun violence has now surpassed motor vehicle crashes as the leading cause of death among children and adolescents. Many states have tried to address some of the dangers of gun violence just described by passing laws that limit, in various ways, who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds." Justice Stephen Breyer added, "The court today severely burdens states' efforts to do so." Rana Epting, executive director of the progressive group Move On, lamented a shameful and outrageous decision, adding, "The conservative-packed Supreme Court, in concert with Republicans in Congress, is ensuring our schools, our grocery stores, and our churches will continue to be targets of violence and not the sanctuaries and safe places they should be." The court has steadily undermined gun laws, recognizing a right to keep guns at home for self-defense in 2008 and extending that right 2 years later. In the New York case, two men sued the state. Under the proper cause law, the men could secure unlimited permission to carry concealed guns in public only if they could demonstrate a special need for self-protection. Lawyers argued that carrying a firearm outside of the home was a fundamental constitutional right. It is not the same extraordinary action that requires an extraordinary demonstration of need. Civil rights and gun safety groups attempted to sway the court. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, argued that lifting controls on guns in public places would harm First Amendment rights such as assembly, association, and speech. Gun control advocates warned that scrapping the law could hit relations between the police and citizens because anyone in contact with law enforcement would be more likely to be legally armed. On Thursday, 23rd of June, the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, said, "The Supreme Court is setting us backwards in dealing with gun violence. This decision is not just reckless, it's reprehensible." Kathy Hochul also said she was prepared to call the legislature back into session to deal with this. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, said she would not be deterred from standing up to the gun lobby and their repeated efforts to endanger New Yorkers. A leading representative of the gun lobby, Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association, NRA, joined Republicans celebrating a watershed win and said, "The right to self-defense and to defend your family and loved ones should not end at your home." But Keechan Sewell, the New York City Police Commissioner, warned gun owners, "If you carry a gun illegally in New York City, you will be arrested. Nothing changes today." Rana Epting of Move On said, "It is hard to imagine a Supreme Court more out of touch with the people. Common sense policies to reduce gun violence are supported by 9 out of 10 Americans. This court is now nothing more than the political arm of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party." Pointing to Mitch McConnell's unprecedented denial of even a hearing to Barack Obama's third nominee, Merrick Garland, now Attorney General, and a confirmation of 3 justices under Donald Trump, Rana Epting said, "Republicans stole seats and packed this court to enact what voters have repeatedly rejected at the ballot box. It is far past time we expand the court, reform it, and restore balance to our judicial system."
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A puppet government in the heart of Africa.
Part 2.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its East rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. he had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December 1, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moïse Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moïse Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. 9 African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002 the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
In the limelight.
A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of the financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Shameful Distinction. U.S. ranked world's biggest perpetrator of financial secrecy. Here's the story. A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. The ranking comes despite U.S. President Joe Biden's campaign trail pledge to bring transparency to the global financial system, go after illicit tax havens, seize stolen assets, and make it more difficult for leaders who steal from their people to hide behind anonymous front companies. In December, following the leak of an enormous trove of tax documents that called additional attention to the country's secretive financial system, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen conceded, "There is a good argument that right now the best place to hide and launder ill-gotten gains is actually the United States." The latest edition of the Financial Secrecy Index, a project of the Tax Justice Network, or TJN, echoes that assessment, faulting the U.S. for its weak corporate tax disclosure rules and overall lack of transparency. In fact, the index awarded the U.S. the highest secrecy score since 2009 when the ranking began. That isn't a prize the U.S. wants to claim for itself, Gary Coleman, the executive director of Transparency International U.S., said in a statement, adding, "The combination of secrecy and size of our financial system puts the U.S. ahead of other notorious secrecy havens like the Cayman Islands and Switzerland. That's a shameful distinction." While noting that some progress has been made over the past year and a half, specifically Congress's passage of a ban on anonymous shell companies, entities often used to hide illicit cash, TJN found that the U.S. now fuels more global financial secrecy than Switzerland, Cayman, and Bermuda combined. TJN also stressed that the shell company law enacted in January 2021 is riddled with loopholes such as limited definitions of which legal entities and beneficial owners must register, 23 baked-in exemptions to registration, and an absence of requirements on all trusts. To improve on this small ranking, TJN urged the U.S. to reciprocally exchange information with other countries by adopting the Common Reporting Standard and become a party to amended Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, steps that would cut its supply of financial secrecy to world by 40%.